Welcome to Living Above the Drama. I'm your host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio, and today I have a very special guest joining us. Her name is Destiny Drake West, and she is the founder and chief executive officer of the Drake Institute of Research and Policy, which is a nonpartisan policy think tank based in Washington, D.C. Destiny spearheads research and technology development for the Institute and establishes partnerships with grassroots organizations and women legislators. Through her work at the Drake Institute, she has developed one of the most expansive public policy taxonomies in the nation. Her policy taxonomy categorizes more than 300 women's policy issues into 35 areas of concentration, which helps facilitate collaboration among researchers and policymakers. She holds a master's degree in advanced study in criminology, law, and society from University of California, Irvine, and a bachelor's degree in public relations from California Baptist University. She also holds a certificate in public policy from Los Angeles African American Women Public Policy Institute and is the recipient of the 2017 Dickman Graduate Research Award for Community Engagement by the University of California, Irvine. For her leadership and civic engagement accomplishments, Destiny has received several congressional awards, including a certificate of recognition from U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, a certificate of special congressional recognition from Congresswoman Karen Bass, and a certificate of special recognition from Congresswoman Maxine Waters. Destiny, welcome. That's an awful lot of accomplishment. I'm so excited to have you on and for you to share your story about the great work that you're doing.
I'm so excited to be here. Thank you so much, Georgiana.
Oh, it's my pleasure. You have quite the resume, my Lord, and you are doing wonderful visionary work of all places in Washington, D.C.
Yes,
it's not exactly paradise right now in Washington, D.C.
Not even close.
Yeah. So tell us all about how you, a young 33-year-old mother of three, started a think tank in Washington, D.C. That's pretty remarkable. And how you are really aiming to work very closely to improve health care and, in general, quality of life for females, for women.
Yes. Well, first of all, just thank you again for having me. I'm so excited to talk about the work we're doing at the Drake Institute of Research and Policy. I got the idea one day about 2 years ago to start a think tank. It had never been an aspiration of mine to pursue research-related work. I had ambitions to run for office someday and maybe just work in the policy space as an analyst or something, and not really look so much into the research side. But then in my professional experience, having worked in the office of Congressman Alcee Hastings and then for a local elected official here in the state of Maryland, I just realized that there were some limitations to the research we had at our disposal to prepare for policy initiatives that we're working on. And so I also noticed that women legislators in particular, were more likely to be impacted by the lack of high quality research available to them. And so I decided, you know what, given the fact that women legislators are more likely to be harshly criticized and penalized for failed policy issues, I would do something to assist them in their efforts to move women forward in society. And so I sat down one day, wrote out a vision, and it was a huge vision that I knew I couldn't accomplish on my own, and started looking through my phone and saying, okay, who could I get to assist me with this? And so I called up several of my friends who also work in the policy space and asked if they would serve on my advisory board or provide some type of support to the development of the Institute. And so fast forward 2 years later, We got the research team together for our first legislative quarter, which just wrapped up last week. And since then, it's just been about building momentum and really getting our name out there and trying to focus on issues that aren't usually tackled in the policy space that would really make an impact on the quality of life that women here in the United States experience.
Yeah, let's talk about that. I mean, we tend to read in the paper. I know I'm just gobsmacked when I read about some of these other countries and what women go through. Just the whole what I call castration. You know, just the clitoral mutilation. The selling of young girls into marriage. I mean, it's just beyond comprehension to us here in this country. So can you talk about what it is specifically, the concerns we have in this country, because they're obviously different than the concerns that are out in other countries?
Absolutely. You know, the international work around women's issues, you're right. It is a very different type of thing. I mean, the mutilation of the female body is definitely a huge issue that's dealt with. But if you look right here on domestic soil, you'll see that we fall behind a lot of developing countries when it comes to issues related to women, particularly maternal health. And so personally, I've experienced what it was like to have a maternal health scare, if you will, where my life was literally in danger. Back in 2008 and again in 2010, I experienced a ruptured ectopic pregnancy. And what that means is the ectopic pregnancy, or my pregnancy, had developed in my fallopian tube and had gotten to the point where I was beginning to bleed internally. And so experiencing that, and especially as a Black woman, it gave me a new perspective on the quality of health care that is available to women here in the United States. And it let me see really up close and personal how some issues that we're faced with are really silent killers in many ways, because they don't make mainstream news depending on who's impacted by it. And so when looking at maternal health care, you'll see that that happens to be an issue that really disproportionately impacts African-American women. And the research shows that it doesn't matter if she is wealthy, well-educated, or lives in a certain area, she will still be 3-4 times more likely to die due to pregnancy-related complications than any of her other counterparts. And so there are other issues like that. I mean, then there's also the issue within the animal welfare space. A lot of people don't realize that when it comes to professional animal caretakers and providers, care providers, that field is heavily dominated by women. And right now, the suicide rate among those women professionals are three and a half times higher than the national average. And so it's just issues like those that tend to not get a lot of discussion in public discourse, especially at the national level or the national scale, that at the Drake Institute, we would really like to just shine the spotlight on a bit more and provide evidence and like high quality research to support the need for more legislation.
Okay, so let's break this down a little bit, because that's a lot. I mean, that's a lot to navigate.
Yes.
What kind of caregivers are you saying have a higher suicide rate?
Veterinarians.
Veterinarians?
Women veterinarians have a higher suicide rate. At right now, I believe it's at 3.5 times the national average. The only reason that I'm aware of this statistic is because at the Institute, we deliberately look for gaps in policy. And so in doing that, our method consists of looking at our 35 policy concentration areas and then really just combing through it with a fine-tooth comb to see where are we missing things? Like what issues are going unnoticed? What's happening there? And as we conducted the preliminary research and I spoke to some of our experts we consult with, one happens to be on our board of advisors. She's a practicing veterinarian and has been for a while now. And she shed light on that. And sure enough, evidence supports the claim that there is a 3.5 times higher suicide rate among women who practice in that field. And there's some speculation as to why that is. But
yes, why is that? That would be the question.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. It's just like dentists have a much higher suicide rate than other doctors. But why is it that women veterinarians do?
Well, so it's still inconclusive. No one really knows exactly why, which is why there's a need for more research. So we'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. But to answer your question, experts speculate that it has something to do with just the nature of the work, having to care for animals and actually care for animals who have been abused. Some of them even having to euthanize some animals and just that the sensitivity that goes with that. And then also just the long hours and the low pay. So even though it is a female-dominated space, they still make less money than their male counterparts. And so it's all of that that experts believe plays into the, I guess you can say, demoralizing experience that women practitioners experience in the veterinarian space. And so we prefer to really just dig a bit deeper by encouraging legislators to introduce legislation that would fund research into this issue, because right now we don't have a lot of data. No one's really looking at, statistically, we have the numbers, but we don't have the whys behind the numbers. So we need
exactly.
more case studies.
Yeah, and you can't fix something if
right.
you don't know what's causing it.
Exactly, exactly.
You know.
Which is why it's so critical that we have legislation that that will fund research on this issue. But again, if no one even knows that the issue exists, then it's difficult to make an ask for that, because as you know, there are so many competing needs in society, and legislators are already super busy with trying to meet those needs legislatively. And so we have to be able to make a compelling case for why this area of
right.
research deserves more funding.
Right. Well, what's interesting is you've got several fields. You have
yes.
first responders. That has a terrible track record in terms of, kind of wellness, in terms of
yes.
suicide, depression,
yes.
addiction. You're dealing
mm-hmm.
with the law enforcement, police officers,
yes.
another
yes.
really bad group. Dentists
yes.
and now veterinarians. They were hypothesizing that dentists may have a high rate of suicide and depression because they're inflicting pain. And it seems that all of these professions, to some extent, even though they're helping professions, it
yes.
may be that when we inflict pain on other living things repeatedly, that
yes.
somehow that causes us to have a reaction that is demoralizing. And
yes.
it's interesting because yet there are people who cause pain all the
yes.
time that don't seem to, they don't take their lives, but the people who are trying to do good, you know.
Yes.
So I don't mean to make light of it, but it is kind of an irony when you look at the bigger picture, you know.
Yes. And then you know what? Also, Georgiana, I spoke with a legislator out in New Jersey. And she was she's a practitioner as well, but she works more from a holistic approach. And so she doesn't use medicines. There's no medicines involved with her treatment of animals. And so she raised an interesting point that we're hoping to explore more through the Institute next year, which is that maybe there's also a component in this that deals with this issue that has something to do with access to pharmaceuticals. You know, and I hadn't really considered that before because, you know, as people cope with different stressors on work. At work, they find different ways to cope. And just even having access to those types of medicines, it could really create an issue.
I had a niece who was married to a veterinarian, and he
mm-hmm.
became a drug addict, and he killed
wow.
himself. So,
wow.
you know, I mean, this is what happens. This is what
yeah.
happens. A lot of times where you're absolutely correct, where there is access to things that can harm. And the other thing, I think that in general, most of our lives, I mean, we're talking about some, you know, really kind of a target to populations, but most of our lives are fairly fraught with stress and pressure in today's world, just dealing with the regulations and electronics and, you know, the whole computer-based, technology-based existence that we now have. So it's very understandable. But you were talking about veterinarians, and then you were talking about, which is pretty shocking as well, you're saying that African-American women, whether they're wealthy, whether they have excellent insurance, none of that matters. There's a four times, you know, possibility that they will receive, let's say, problematic care that could cause their mortality. Do you want to talk more about that?
Yes. So, again, because this is such a personal issue for me, being that I've experienced ectopic pregnancies and have not, well, at least I didn't feel as though I received the quality of care that I needed at that time of trauma and just pain and just all of that. I believe that it's important that we look into why there's a disparity, you know, in terms of what types of care certain women receive. So those same statistics are very similar for Native American women as well. And when you look at that and you start asking the question, well, why is it that, you know, some of these women of color, are receiving less than our best when it comes to maternal health care. If it's not for, you know, if it has something to do with their education, if it has something to do with how much money they have and therefore being able to afford some of the best insurance out there, what is it? Well, so far, the only thing that most policy, I guess, analysts and people in the policy space have really begin to narrow down is that there's a race element here at play. And until we begin to deal with race and the way it impacts the quality of service that women and just people in general receive, but since we're talking about women today, the quality of care that women get, we're going to continue to see these outcomes. And so what we're seeing now across the policy space nationally is a push for a couple of things. One, to establish maternal health review boards, and their whole job would be to figure out a way to address the disparities. But then also to begin to standardize the process by which we track and report these types of incidents. So right now, state to state, hospital to hospital, you know, there may be a different way to determine if a woman died due to pregnancy-related causes. And because of that, it's hard for researchers, like the ones we have at the Institute, to really say how problematic this issue is. And so one way that, you know, we're trying to tackle that right now is just by having conversations with insurance providers to see if there's any way to incentivize having their medical staffers and contractors to undergo sensitivity training related to, I guess, diversity and cultural competency, things like that. But until we see that become more widespread and become the norm as opposed to the exception to the rule, then we're going to continue to see these disparities. At least that's my guess.
Right. So what would be really fascinating here, I'm sure you are well aware that today there is a larger population of African American and other cultural physicians and doctors and nurse practitioners out there. It would be interesting to see if having a health practitioner of similar or at least related culture changed the numbers in terms of the outcomes. Don't you think that would be really interesting to take a peek at?
I do. I absolutely do, which is why I'm 100% for legislation that would allocate funding for that type of research.
Right.
Yeah, so there's a need for it. And, you know, as many legislators as we can get on board to, you know, see it as a problem, as a true problem, the more legislation we can actually get passed. And
wonderful,
that legislation,
yeah.
Of course, it's, yeah, it'll start the clock, but, you know, when it comes to research, research is very slow moving. And so some of these studies can take, you know, 10 years to really get some,
yes.
To get some conclusive findings. And so in the meantime, like, we still have to figure out some steps forward so that we are not putting the lives of women in unnecessary risk, you know.
Absolutely. We need to take a break. This is such a fascinating conversation. We need to take a break, but we're going to come back. And when we come back, let's talk about, I mean, because, you know, it's like a needle in the haystack. Could it be
yes.
that certain cultures, and maybe African-American women are one of them, have a propensity more towards blood clots or more towards toxemia? Or, I mean, there's so many things you could start to look at. You could look at,
yes.
you know, seeing practitioners of similar background, if that reduces
yes.
the numbers. Or, you know, is it a genetic thing? Is it, there's
yes.
so many ways that that could be explored. What a conversation. We're going to be back.
Yes.
In a minute, listeners, don't go away, and we will have more of Destiny Drake West.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donatio, relationship communication expert, and number one national best-selling, award-winning author, Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donatio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing Behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donatio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donatio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
Talking with Destiny Drake West, who is the founder and chief executive officer of the Drake Institute of Research and Policy, which is a nonpartisan policy think tank based in Washington, D.C. We've been having just a great conversation about ways in which your organization is attempting to bring more equity and less disparity across the board to women. One of the things you and I talked about on the pre-interview was the role of engaging men in this conversation. It's a really fascinating, that's a really kind of double-edged sword, fascinating discussion, you know, because the bottom line is, look, for anybody who's watching television these days and watching the Senate and watching the House of Representatives and what have you, what we know is that there's so much partisan divide just in terms of gender, just in terms of race. I mean, you know, it's like there are two different governments going on, you know. One is representative of, you know, a more realistic population. And the other one is like from the 1950s. So we need to kind of engage that. You want to talk about that, because you had some very interesting things to say about it.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more with you, Georgiana. There is a need to keep the dialogue going with men, with our male allies, because, as you know, the House of Representatives as well as the Senate, and it's still pretty much dominated by men. Not pretty much, it's definitely dominated by men. I think we only make up about a quarter of congressional members at this time, like women. And that same thing can be found at the state, county, and municipal levels as well, where there are more male legislators than there are women legislators. And so what that means for us is, in order to get really critical pieces of legislation passed, we have to be able to have these conversations with legislators who are men to help them see the value and the urgency in some of these issues. And so at the Drake Institute, we have established a 10-city public engagement program. And the point of that is to deploy ambassadors at the grassroots level to help facilitate that dialogue. So I know during that pre-interview, we were talking about the support that's needed. So yes, at the grassroots level, there's a lot of support. And you'll see that it's not just women who care about women issues at the grassroots level. There are men who get up every day and tirelessly advocate for change, for progress on these issues. The problem, as I've seen it to be, is getting them connected to legislators who will care enough to introduce those bills, who will care enough to work across the aisle with their colleagues to get this legislation passed, and who will make sure that the legislation is effective in addressing the issues at hand. So what we're aiming to do there is really create this national discourse, like reshape it even, where, yes, men are involved, but also by empowering women to really look at these issues and use not just theoretical experience that, you know, you can get from taking classes at college and things like that, but also their lived experiences. And so that's why we really aim to tap into the thought leadership of women legislators serving at all levels, because they can apply that lived experience and really help guide the direction that policy goes in when it comes to addressing these issues. So, and I think it can be done in a very civil way, in a very productive way, when we discuss the issues in a way that is inclusive, and that's what we do. So, and in none of our processes do we exclude men. That would be a disservice to everyone that we're trying to reach right now, just because when you're looking at women and their families, it doesn't just extend to their children. It also extends to their spouses and also to their fathers, their uncles, their cousins, and then they have male sons, they have male children. And so they will always be present in the process. What we're trying to do, though, is shift away from having a solely male dominant perspective at play and really dig into more of the female thought leadership, because when you look at certain issues, and we talked about this a little bit earlier too, like abortions, it's a highly sensitive issue that is extremely partisan in many ways for a number of reasons. For some, it's religious. For some, it's it goes against their moral code. Some of it is just ignorance. They don't understand the pregnancy process, or there's a dispute as to where life begins. And so what we want to do is look at who's been leading that dialogue. And for decades, it's just been men. And now we're in 2019, going into 2020, and we are still split as a country on this issue. And so, yes, it is absolutely vital that we engage men on these issues, but it is more important at this time that we empower women and really tap into that female thought leadership on some of these issues, because it doesn't matter so much to me where a woman stands in terms of her party affiliation as much as it matters to me to hear her voice. So I would prefer to hear a Republican woman's voice on the issue of abortion rights than I would a male perspective, because we've already heard that. We know where men, Republicans, stand on that. The goal here is now to have more women speaking on it.
Right. Well, that, of course, that makes tremendous sense. Let's just recognize that what we have now in terms of legislators is a tremendous improvement. I told you I'm old enough to be your grandmother. So when I'm looking at what we had back in the 1950s and 60s, and even the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, it was a whole other animal. It was just, you know, white men across the big picture was all white guys. And
yes.
Things have changed. Things are changing, and that's terribly, terribly important. But I think we need to recognize that things can happen. But, of course, there are tremendous issues. And the issues, for instance, let's just take gun control and prescription drug costs.
Yes.
There are bipartisan bills that have been passed that are sitting on the Speaker of the House, Senate speakers won't even vote on them because it offends the lobbyists, it offends the gun money people and the drug money people. So, we know this. You know, all you have to do is turn on the television. It doesn't say, you know. So how do we change the reality that whether it's a male or female, I mean, I am shocked at some of the comments that the women legislators are making. So it just isn't, I mean, I want to be fair about this, because gender does not guarantee integrity, you know.
You are so right. You are so right. And you know what? I'm so glad you asked that question, because, so many of our elected officials have been bought off. Just period. It doesn't matter if they're male or female. You're absolutely right there. And what we're hoping to do is to get back to objective fact-finding rather than looking for statistics that have been skewed or slanted to serve the purposes of one party over another. And I think research is the best place to do that. And what makes the Drake Institute of Research and Policy so unique is that we are self-funded, and we have the independence that we need to remain objective just by looking at the issues and looking at them from the perspective of what's factual and what isn't, and then being able to really set our policy agenda. And by doing that, by remaining independent of special interest groups, independent of government funding, it gives us also the flexibility to create information products that are easily digestible to legislators who are in such a need of, I guess you could say, assistance and support when it comes to gaining the information or acquiring the information they need to develop policy, strong policy. And so what happens is it's kind of like a what comes first, the chicken or egg situation, when you're looking at the role that lobbyists play in our political arena. So you have legislators. I tend to want to be optimistic and say that most of them, male and female alike, go into office with the intentions of doing the right thing. What happens along the way is that they understand that it requires a significant amount of money to be reelected, to one, be elected, but then also to be reelected, to hold your seat long enough to really affect change. And so lobbyists happen to wield a lot of influence because they have a lot of money at their disposal to contribute to those campaigns and things like that. And that's important to recognize because, you know, we talk a lot about getting people more engaged in the voting process, right? Well, if we got more people active, just civically engaged and active on these issues, then legislators can turn away from big dollar lobbyists, you know, for funding their campaigns and more towards the people who can provide those small dollar donations to those campaigns to fund them through a successful election. And guess who gets to set the agenda? The people. And so we're hoping that through our work at the Institute, we can start engaging more people at the grassroots level and getting them excited and invested in this process so that as they're seeing our products, like, you know, we're analyzing bills and critiquing their efficacy and things like that, they'll be able to determine which of these legislators they want to continue to see in office and put their money behind. And that will begin to create a culture shift in our political climate.
Well, we can certainly hope that. I will share with you, we didn't talk about this in the pre-interview, but back in 2011-12, the very end of 2011, beginning of 2012, I wrote a book that it became a number one bestseller, which I was very, very pleased about because I wrote it for my institution, the institution I work for. And part of it was talking about what happened to us in our culture. Why is everyone so stressed out, freaked out, doing a million things? I talk to health professionals all day. They're taking 2 and 3 degrees and courses, and people, they can't stop themselves. Everybody's on the fast track. Everybody is more, 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 more.
Yes.
And so in the book, I lay out and talk about what happened back in the mid to late 1980s, there were two big things that shifted. Number one, the TV show, The Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. When the average American, we had no idea, even upper class people had no idea the way wealthy people were living. They just had no idea. And they were looking at yachts, and they were looking at castles and islands and just these insane lifestyles. And all of a sudden, everybody wanted to be a commodities broker, and everybody, you know, you had social workers and nurses quitting and trying to get into finance. And then in the late 1980s, we had the Bush bank scandal. The bottom line is we had a moral compass failure in the mid to the late 80s. And what I was writing in the book was about obesity. If you look, and if you read the book, you could actually track the shift in moral attitude, the increase in ambition, and the increase in wanting more and more and more, to the escalation of obesity in the United States. What's so fascinating about this, and the reason I'm bringing it up, I don't know at this point, because what are we looking at? 85 mm-hmm. to 95, we're looking at almost 40 years ago. Our
yes.
culture has become tainted by a lack of integrity, ethical
mm-hmm.
integrity, moral integrity.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't that what we're looking at now being played yes. out in the public arena?
Yes.
So the question, and this is a big question, and I'm sorry for bringing it up because I'll probably get tomatoes thrown at me. I personally believe that we've moved from a culture of values and a culture, mm-hmm. quite frankly, a spiritual group
yeah.
of people, a prayerful group of people, to
mm-hmm.
a group of people that really don't care about anything but the bottom line. I mean, I'm listening to the television and listening to voters saying, I don't care what he does. I don't care who he insults. I don't care what,
yep.
I don't care about anything. You know what I care about? I want to know how my 401k is doing.
Yep.
When you hear this and you realize that this has corroded, I mean, the PAC, you know, the PAC
mm-hmm.
money, that
mm-hmm.
has corroded
mm-hmm.
the
yes.
entire, and that isn't even that old. How old is the PAC money now? 35
hmm.
years? How many years?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Okay, so what I'm saying is we have a moral corruption that's going on in our government, in our legislators, in our society, where all that people care about is what's in it for me. So I'm going to
yes.
ask you, and this may be an unfair
mm-hmm.
thing, I'm going to ask you to address your perception. I mean, you're a very smart woman. You've really accomplished a great deal in this area. You've met a lot of people. You know a lot of people. You know what's going
mm-hmm.
on. You're working in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
How are we going to take a look at, first of all, we have to look at ourselves. We have to
yes.
be honest and evaluate
mm-hmm.
where we're coming from as human
yes.
beings before we
mm-hmm.
can then effectuate any kind of successful change in the society. Now, we're going to take another break because I can't believe, oh, my God, the time is flying by. We're going to take another short break. We're going to come right back, and
okay.
we will probably have something like 10, 11 minutes left. If you could please address that, because I think
yes.
the real problem here is we've got our heads buried in the sand. We're not looking at how we're creating these problems,
mm-hmm.
you
mm-hmm.
know, and this
yes.
has got to be, this has got to be an urgent need. So don't go
yes.
anybody. Isn't this a fun conversation that we're having with Destiny? Okay. We will be back in just a moment for more discussion.
Dr. Gass is on the advisory board of HealthCorp, a new program which was begun by Dr. Mehmet Oz.
65% are overweight and 35% are obese, and the sharpest rise in this country is between the age group of 4 to 8 years old.
Throughout his career, he has been inspired by patients who have experienced dramatic recoveries through lifestyle changes.
The National Institute of Whole Health is a perfect example of how people will learn to really take control of their lives in a healthy way. What they've done is they've collected basically the who's who of integrative health, and they've brought them together to give a series of lectures where they can then communicate with health professionals to basically deliver the message that we have to look at medicine from a different perspective.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health and their accredited professional continuing educational programs, go to www.wholepersonhealthcare.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL.
If someone said you could transform your life and enhance your relationships by using a few simple communication techniques that can be applied in almost any setting, would you want to learn these skills? If the answer is yes, you've picked up the right book. This easy-to-read guide is loaded with simple skills that have been scientifically shown to have a huge impact on our relationships. By using the steps in this book, you will be able to enhance not only your life, but the lives of everyone around you. If you have the intention to practice and apply these skills, it will become a natural part of who you are. A true must-read for anyone who wants to transform their professional and personal lives. Changing behavior. Immediately transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills by Georgiana Donadio.
You can purchase Changing Behavior by Dr. Georgiana Donadio by visiting Amazon.com, where it is available in both Kindle ebook and paperback.
Are you tired of not feeling heard and not feeling valued? Are you longing to receive the love and respect you want? There is a solution right now. Transform your relationships with easy-to-learn, proven communication skills. Dr. Georgiana Donadio, relationship communication expert and number one national best-selling, award-winning author of Changing Behavior, explores the unconscious patterns contributing to stress, lack of fulfillment, and our relationship interactions. By learning and applying the simple principles of behavioral engagement, which has been clinically tested in leading hospitals, to develop mindful pure presence, you can experience the happiness and fulfillment you deserve in your relationships. Begin changing your behavior today with Living Above the Drama radio show host, Dr. Georgiana Donadio. Call 888-354-4325. 888-354-HEAL. Call now.
Become credentialed for the emerging medical health and wellness field. Work within healthcare environments or start your own private practice and bill for your services with your own NPI number. Train for this exciting specialty in patient-focused health and wellness education with the National Institute of Whole Health, NIWH, the only nationally accredited training program for patient health education and advocacy. Open to credentialed health and education professionals, our training qualifies for health educator liability insurance, a national provider identification number, and our expert-prepared billing and coding manual.
For more information about the National Institute of Whole Health, visit www.niwh.org or call 1-888-354-HEAL, 888-354-4325.
Talking to Destiny Drake West, who is a remarkably successful young woman at 33 years old, a mother of three, and she is the founder and chief executive officer of the Drake Institute of Research and Policy, a nonpartisan policy think tank in Washington, D.C., and she started it all on her own, which is really quite exciting. Destiny, before the break, I was posing this rather kind of, it's kind of a elephant in the room question, okay?
Yes.
Look, we drank the Kool-Aid back in the 80s, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We saw Robin Leach with the lifestyles of the rich and famous. We saw the most excessive, the most really decadent greed and avarice and, hoarding that was going on. And then we had some real political issues, bank scandals and what have you.
Yes.
And so we took our direction away from being happy and content with our homes and our children and our partners and our, you know, our communities. We moved away from that to much bigger dreams. And as a result, we've really lost our moral compass. How do you, as a visionary and as someone who has started this big vision, how are you going to address that? Because isn't that what this is all about?
It definitely does get to the heart of the issue. Greed, is having this sense of they're never having enough of material things, And so capitalism it's fundamental to the United States. I mean, it's part of our culture. Let's just face it. It is what it is. We are a capitalist society. And I like to think that there has always been this keeping up with the Joneses dynamic at play, looking across the fence and seeing what your neighbors have that maybe you don't have. I think it's just that it's been amplified more in the age of the internet and television and reality TV, I think has definitely a factor in just the moral decline of our country. And so, yes, it's going to be a huge, huge task to redirect people's attention from those material things to what's more important. And I think what I've found in my personal life is that there are still people out there who care a lot about just having enough to provide for their family, to have a roof over their head, and to have food on their table, and to be able to, you know, have transportation to get their families to and from work and school. And, you know, they don't have all of these ambitions that will create this, this sense of discontentment, if you will. And so I think when it comes to just getting people excited about what's more important, it's going to have to, what's going to require more of these types of conversations. We're going to have to change the narrative. We have to start saying out loud and in public spaces in really grand ways that we care about other issues. We care about our health. We care about working well with our neighbors. We care about being more inclusive, and we care about really moving this nation forward. We actually have to start making those declarative statements. And so I think it really does, language, speech has a lot to do with it, because right now the messaging we're getting in the media and on television is the complete opposite. We're hearing a lot about, you know, I don't like these people, and these people are a threat, and I don't want to live in this community. This community, you know, it's subpar in some way. But I think if we start amplifying the voices of just everyday people who really are finding ways to be content within their marriages, within the work that they do to earn a living for their families, I think it will begin to spread. Will it spread as quickly as gossip, you know, about, or just even, will it spread as quickly as, I don't know, chatter about the most recent celebrity and the trips they're taking to Dubai or wherever? No, it's not going to be as exciting immediately, because we have become desensitized to those types of things. Like, we've become desensitized to the beauty in having simplicity in our lives. And so I think the antidote right now is just addressing these issues head on. And so if we know that we are living in a capitalist society, then I think we have to really do a good job of painting a very clear picture for people, so that they can see what's at stake here if we don't start to really address these issues. And we can do that by looking at the fiscal note. How much does it cost us as a society? And I'm talking about monetarily. How much are we spending when we neglect certain, like the healthcare needs of certain populations? How much does it cost us as a society when we don't spend enough on education? Just looking at the way we allocate funding, even at the congressional level, in terms of budgeting, what types of programs are we budgeting for, and are we investing more of our money into, we can really get a good look at where our values are. So we do have values. They're just not on simple things anymore. We're showing that we care a lot about investments and things like that. But how can we restore this sense of importance or value to issues that impact everyday people in their lives, you know? And I feel like we have to do that by looking at the cost and the potential cost savings.
Well, I'm going to throw a little monkey wrench into that, into that perspective. I think that that's all we look at. All we look at is what is the financial cost of something. We think in very business terms in our culture now. And what we really need to look at to, you know, turn the ship around is, what is the human cost? What is the, when we look at so many things like addiction, depression, suicide, incarceration, I mean, we could just go down the list. We could just make a list of never-ending things that are profoundly impacting people's misery. The reason we're in the situation we're in right now culturally is because half of the country feels that they didn't get theirs.
Yes.
And when you start having people who don't feel that they got theirs, what you're really looking at is you're looking at people feeling deprived of the basic human recognition, the basic human being valued, the basic human having community and belonging and maybe having family or love. We need to get down. I mean, money is, look, people always say, oh, the cost, the financial cost of this. Forget the financial cost. We're losing human capital. We're losing people. Look at what's going on with, I mean, incarceration is just woo. I mean, that alone, we're looking at suicide of veterans. I mean, there's such a long list of it that if we only look at the return on investment, and this is what happens, as you well know, what it's all about is the ROI. What is my return on investment? But we have to look at the cost of humanity. What's going on? I mean, people are not happy, Destiny. I don't have to tell you that. You know, I mean, it's the holiday season. People are miserable out there. Miserable, you know, and it's all about, you know, again, the money. So what do you see apart from the rule, you know, a return on investment? No, I can't believe this. I can't believe this interview has come to an end. I have no time left. But what do you think? What do you think can be done other than talk about money to make people realize how we're all connected and what when one of us, one group of us is suffering, we're really all suffering. And the bottom line is, and I like to use this analogy, it's like cancer. When the body has cancer in it, ultimately, it kills the body, and it doesn't just kill the kidney or just kill the liver. It kills the whole body. So we've got to come to a place. Do you see any solution legislatively? Maybe education that might change it?
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to continue to emphasize the importance of looking at the financial cost. I know I hear you completely, but I just know historically, in order to move and create change, like positive change, sometimes you really have to hit people where it hurts, and oftentimes it's their finances. So I'll say that. But as far as really changing the hearts of people, which I think there is definitely a need for, I 100% agree with you there. We can start in our K-12 schools with really looking at inclusivity training in our curriculum and seeing is there a way to really impress upon the young and moldable hearts of our students, you know, at that age, to really get them to see the beauty and value in diversity, the beauty and value in working collaboratively with their peers, and seeing if we can foster that type of attitude through their young adult lives and into adulthood. And so I think that's the way to do it. But right now, I mean, it's really difficult. I'm not going to say impossible, but it's kind of difficult to really try to change the heart of people, because that's what we're talking about right now, how people feel
their
about
beliefs. It's their beliefs, isn't it? For sure.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, this has been a wonderful interview. Tell people how they can learn about the work you're doing. What is the website? What is the contact information?
Yes. So you can follow our work and our progress at www.drakeinstitute.org. And we're also on social media. We're on Twitter, and we're also on Facebook and LinkedIn and Instagram as well. So you can follow our progress there. And if you want to learn more specifically about the policy issues that we are studying, definitely look out for our upcoming journal, our quarterly journal. It will be released next spring. And you can purchase a copy on our website and potentially on Amazon, but more information is to come. So just definitely stay in the loop, join our mailing list, and if you have questions, you can call to the office at 202-891-1988.
Destiny West, thank you so much for being with us today, and thank you and bless you for all of the good work you're doing on behalf of all of us. Listeners, don't forget to join me again next week for another inspiring, informational, and uplifting show here on Living Above the Drama.